Hey there, writer person. Are you always having amazing ideas? Do you sometimes struggle to write them down? No pen? Cell phone run out of juice? Then you need FingerPen. After years of mildly unethical surgical experiments on prisoners and the homeless, you can now never be without a pen. That's right. No more awkward situations of missing out on that cute guy or gal's phone number. No more not being able to add to your shopping list as you shop. No more missing out on writing on the forehead of your colleague who's fallen asleep on the job. And no more losing out on that amazing idea for a novel while you're on the shitter. Surgically inserted into the end of the digit of your choice, FingerPen is always there when you need it. Right on the end of your finger. FingerPen users should be careful when rubbing their eyes, going to the bathroom, and in other intimate situations.
Well, Tommy.
Johnny.
Here we are again.
Yeah.
We've got a humongous show today, haven't we?
Yeah, we've got poetic royalty on. I think that's fair to say, isn't it?
I think that's fair enough.
We're looking at people's work in progress again.
Mm-hmm.
Smack my whip up. We still haven't got a name for it. We're just throwing them out there.
You tell?
And quite an interesting... We'll leave it as a surprise. People on Twitter might have already seen this in the last... week or so, but a little surprise at the end.
Yeah.
A sad tale that we're trying to bring some happiness to.
We've almost got too much,
yeah.
Haven't we, Tommy? If we were to lay out 100 Toms end to end along the ground, that wouldn't reach halfway through the show.
No.
That's how big this episode
I believe
is.
It's normal to measure these things in double-decker buses or Olympic swimming pools, isn't it?
Well, unless you know a Tom.
Yeah, true.
And then...
True.
Mm.
So yeah, we'll get straight into the interview with Ian McMillan, poet extraordinaire. But actually, we should just quickly ask, what have you been writing this week?
I have been writing a little bit of the murder mystery, and Katie and I have got our heads together again about the marriage
ticking
show. How about that? So we have actually written some stuff. Yeah. What about you, Tommy? What about you?
Not a lot, really. I've got myself in that weird, funny place again, and I've kind of told myself off for it. So I've kind of got my plan all laid out, my timeline for my kid's story, and I've done that thing where it's like, right, I'm waiting for the perfect time to start it. When I've got a big clear block
Come on,
of time,
Tom, you know we've...
Which doesn't exist, does it? I know that.
Yeah, you can't wait for the muse. You can't wait
for the... I suddenly realised the other day that's what I was doing. I was like, oh, well, you... Come on.
Yeah.
Grab half hour or an hour here and there rather than go, right, I'll get everything perfect. This is... I'm going to lash into this and get it... I think because I want to get it done quite quickly, ironically, is what I mean.
You just want to fly at it.
Does that make sense to people? Someone else say that makes sense.
Mm.
I don't want it hanging around for ages, so I've been putting it off for a little while. Again, however you word this, it doesn't seem to make that much sense.
I think it's a common thing, isn't it? It's like waiting for Venus to enter Capricorn or whatever before.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything just feels right.
But anyway, I've said that out loud now, so I've acknowledged that is happening.
That's good.
And unlike previous times where that's taken 6 or 7 years to work out, that's only like a week. So that's better, isn't it? That's good. Anyway... Here's an interview with Ian McMillan.
Hey, listen, should we kick things off?
Yeah, may as well while we're all here.
Mm. I was thinking, what better way to introduce a guest such as we have today than with a little bit of introductory verse? What do you think of that?
Great idea, great.
We are extremely excited and filled with delight to welcome a poet you'll have heard, or you might. He's a wordsmith who deals in words with appeal. He's also a caster, not the small wheel or the sugar, but a master of the spoken word, especially the verb. A long-lasting broadcaster, casting spells with charming yarns, he is often hailed the Bard of Barnsley. For years, ears and airwaves he's been filling. Ladies and gentlemen, Ian McMillan.
God, that is fantastic. That really is great. Yeah,
I do love a tortured rhyme, don't you?
I love tortured rhymes. I really do.
They're really satisfying.
Johnny's addicted to them, actually. Whenever he writes some little songs for the shows, and the lyrics are always like a bag of words falling down the stairs in the middle. So they just kind of won't quite stop. Yeah. I like a good old-fashioned cheeky rhyme, me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But John is definitely for the drawn-out tortured.
I like a triple rhyme. Do you know what I mean?
I'd always like rhymes that are really obvious. And then I like those mono-rhymed ones, you know, where the same line rhymes each time. And so it starts off something really obvious. And then it gets more and more difficult. And I'm always in awe of people who can write things like, you know, villanelles or pantoums or serious limericks, you know, somebody like Luke Wright, who was a kind of master of rhyme.
Mm.
And I do try and rhyme myself sometimes, and I like to work with people. But when I was a young man, you know, I remember when I was first starting out, I tried to get people not to rhyme. Mm. When I used to do writing workshops way back in the late 70s, early 80s, people would turn up with their rhyming verse.
Mm.
And I was some daft kid, and I go, "Look, what are you making it rhyme for, Frank? Stop rhyming, for God's sake." And they go, "Yeah, but if it don't rhyme, it's not a poem." And I go, "Look, in this space, you don't have to rhyme." And they go, they'd really try their best not to rhyme. And then I realised, after about 10 years, what an arrogant youth I was. And then I went, "Please come back and start rhyming." They went, "Too late, we've gone." Oh, dear, I wish I could get them back. And so, look, I didn't mean it. I was just being daft.
was that a trend thing then? That it just wasn't cool to rhyme?
Yeah, that's what it was. I'd, as a young man, you know, I'd been reading lots of people who didn't rhyme. And so when these elderly people turned up to me writing workshop, there was a guy called Eddie Hennigan, and he'd turn up with his rhyming verse, and he'd kind of torture the line to make it rhyme. So that instead of putting "I like on the street," and he'd put "the street walked down I," and "I ate the pie," and the pie was in my eye. And I go, "Look, Eddie, just stop rhyming." And then he'd write them, but then he'd go like, "the street walked down me, and the pie agreed." And he couldn't do it. And then we did mention there's a great form called a pantoum, a rhyming form called a pantoum. And Eddie became obsessed with pantoums. I said, "Look, Eddie, try a pantoum. It's a four-line verse, and the third line of the verse is the same as the first line of the second verse," or something like that. And he'd become obsessed with them. And he'd go, "Ian, I've only written 38 this week, and here they are." And then there was always this other fella came to the writing workshop, and he never read a thing. You often get him at writing workshops, and he'd sit there, and he'd have his poems in a pile of papers.
Mm.
And then we'd go, "Right, George, read yours." And he'd go, "Not this week. No, I'm not ready. Not yet." And then the week after, you go, "Come on, George. It's your turn, man." And you go, "Not ready, not ready."
I like to think that maybe George was turning up and that was actually his poem and he never realised. And he goes back to his wife every week and goes, did you read one out?"
It was conceptual, eh?
"Yeah, I read the 'Not This Week' poem. It didn't go down well again. I'll try it again next week."
That was it. "Not this week." He didn't seem to like it.
Yeah, he didn't get it.
There was another bloke who came to those workshops and he was convinced that the script of the first episode of Bonanza, which he wrote, he left it on the bus, on the Rotherham bus, and that guy from Hollywood saw it on the Rotherham bus and pinched it. And he said, "Do you know Bonanza? My idea, lad." He'd go, "Us, Little John, Adam, all mine." And I go, "Look, I've got to tell you that the bloke from Hollywood wouldn't often be on the Rotherham bus." Because, well, he was. He was there and he pinched it. Oh, dear.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So what was your introduction to poetry originally? What got you into it? Take us back to your younger, more impressionable self.
Well, I mean, I think there was three things, really. First of all, I think if it comes from before you were born, then my dad had an auntie who was a Scottish rhyming Victorian balladeer.
Mm. Oh,
wow. It was called, what was her first name? Bella Howardson. And she wrote these ballads, and they were Victorian ballads of a certain kind, but she also wrote me dad rhyming letters that he kept. And so if it comes through your genes...
Mm, that's a strong one, yeah.
That's maybe where it comes from.
Except there was rhyming in that, so maybe not.
Well, he was proud of them. You know, he'd read them to me, you know, and I'd go, "Well, I shouldn't rhyme that, Dad."
Except from an early age.
Yeah, from an early age. And then my mother and dad met as pen pals in the Second World War. So my dad's from Scotland, my mum's from Barnsley. And they met each other as pen pals. Wow. So writing was always important. So writing in the house you know, seen as important because of that, because they talk about these letters. And then I was born in 1956, I'm 67, and so that meant that as a child, I was part of a wonderful educational experiment called the West Riding of Yorkshire, which I often talked about, which was the chief education officer was a genius called Sir Alec Clegg, who was kind of forgotten these days. And he just said, all children are creative, so which is true.
Brilliant,
so that in our class, we'd read poems and write poems all the time. At the end of every lesson, you'd write a poem, you'd sing a song, you'd dance a dance, you'd draw a drawing, you'd paint a picture. And so I was always surrounded by it in that way, you know, the idea. And also it was always the idea that you can do this. Always encouraged. That's why I always encourage people.
And presumably after that, you were rigorously assessed.
I do know, I wasn't. That was a great thing. They had this fantastic thing called the Thorn Scheme. In those days, you did the 11 plus, apart from in my part of the West Riding, where they said, we're not doing the 11 plus, we're doing a thing called the Thorn Scheme, where they just kind of glanced at your work. I went, oh, yeah, you seem creative. You can go to the grammar school with all those other fools who did the 11 plus. Yeah, the Thorn Scheme. So, no, to be honest, I don't think I've ever been rigorously assessed for anything. So that's good. I've got away with it so far.
Yeah, how have you got through life so well? I've never been assessed properly.
Never, thank God.
Yeah.
So then, you know, you think, well, I can be a poet. And so I would start writing poems, teenage poems. And then also, as you can tell, I'm a bit of a show-off, you know, I like to perform. And so me and my mate formed a little band, and I liked to play the drums in the band. And then we would stand up in folk clubs and read poems, because there weren't many places you could read the poems out. But folk clubs, they had these singers' nights, kind of come all ye's, they'd call them. And there'd be just a mixture of things. So somebody would sing a sea shanty, and somebody would sing a Bob Dylan song, and somebody would sing their own song. Then they say, we've got a couple of lads here who are going to read their own poems. We'd read them out, and it taught you how to read out in public. So, you know, it's been with me for a long time, this kind of writing poems and reading poems. I've never felt like a time when it wasn't there, to be honest.
And is that all you've done? Have you ever had a proper job, Ian?
Yes, I have. I've had two proper jobs.
Right.
When I left school, my parents encouraged me to go to college. They said, because they hadn't been. So go to college. So I went to North Staffordshire Polytechnic.
Oh, okay.
And did a thing called Modern Studies, which was great.
Right.
English history, politics and sociology. So I left there. At the same time, I was doing little bits of gigs up and down. But then I thought, well, I can't make a living at this. I was not making any money from it. I was making odd bits, but not enough. So I went to work on a building site in Sheffield. And then I got a sack from there because I was in charge of the stores and I forgot to lock the door.
Ooh.
And somebody came and stole all the doors out the stores. Here I am talking in rhyme. They took all the doors out the stores. And then in this one, they said, well, we're going to have to sack you. They used to call me Degree because I've got a degree. Naren, Degree, we're going to have to sack you because they've stolen all the doors. And so I said, all right, I'll take my punishment. So I got the sack. And then the next day in the Sheffield Star, the building firm was called Hassell Homes. There was an advert in the Sheffield Star that said, doors for sale, just like Hassell's. So the coppers nabbed the villains. And the great thing about the building site was I could have the odd day off to go and do a gig.
Yeah.
So that was all right. And then I went to work in a tennis ball factory in Barnsley, making tennis balls. And that was, I thought, well, it was three shifts and it was just me stood at a machine. And I thought, well, this will be all right because just because it's a mechanical task, I'll be able to think about poems. And in the end, it wasn't. It almost killed me creatively because you had to concentrate.
Losing three fingers later, you realise you do need to concentrate.
Yeah, see, I couldn't even add up when I'm writing a haiku. So then I had to, at that time, Yorkshire Arts Association, who were the local equivalent of Arts Council England, were giving out these grants. This is 1983. And they give you up to £1,000 if you gave your job up.
Wow.
And my wife was working as a teacher at the time, and my parents have always been very supportive. So I applied for this £1,000 because I wanted to give my job up because I was getting an odd gig, and I thought, well, obviously, if you got more time, you'd be able to do more stuff. And weirdly, I applied for this £1,000, and they gave me £800, which isn't that much less. But I always think, psychologically, it sounded a lot less. So you kind of go, £1,000, £800. But luckily, my wife and my parents have always been very supportive. And they went, go on then, give your job up. Right, I will. So I gave my job up. And then you stand there going, right, I'm here. I'm ready. Come on. I'm here, world. And then we know this as freelancers, you will always say yes. So then I started whirling around and somebody rang up and said, do you want to do some writing workshops up and down South Yorkshire? I went, yes. And somebody else said, do you want to come into a school and do some poems? I went, yes. Mm. And she ended up saying yes all the time, which leads to exciting adventures.
Do you want to come and shout at some people to make them stop rhyming poems? Yes.
Exactly. God, that was so much fun. And I got paid for shouting them to stop writing. That was too. It was the WEA, the Workers Educational Association. And I always remember that just before the end, you know what this is like, just before the end of the session, somebody would get a long poem out and read it. And as they're reading it, the bus you should have caught went past the library. You think, oh, you know, there's 2 hours till the bus. Oh, I've got to walk home. But yes, I've never had a proper job, really, apart from those two, the building site and the tennis ball factory. And so I've been freelance since 1983. That's nearly 40 years. Yeah. Can you believe it? Still not being rigorously assessed.
Still not, not been caught out yet. Yeah,
I always think that, not being caught out. So somebody's going to come like that and go, hello, Ian, we're here.
and knock on the door.
You fraud. Get out of here.
Asking for their 800 quid back.
That's right. Plus interest for 40 years.
That sounds like, well, it sounds like a successful career to have dodged being assessed as well. But we are the Failing Writers podcast and we're intrigued.
I've got a few failures to tell you about.
Yeah, tell us about the bits that didn't quite go your way.
All right, I've got three very specific ones.
Okay, brilliant.
I mean, there's millions, but this is three. when I was first freelance, you might remember in The Guardian, there used to be a thing called Media Guardian, mm-hmm. and it had all the adverts at the back for writers in residence.
Yeah.
And there was a writer in residence wanted in Stourbridge. This is 1983 or four. And so I remember I got the train to Stourbridge and it was in a library and I was sat in the library and there were several other people who would apply for the job. And we were all being interviewed. Mm. And I remember they kind of said, so, you know, how did you, I said, I'm freelance. And I told them the story about the £800. And I said, you know, this £800 has kept me going for a while, but now it's more or less run out. So, you know, that's why I'm applying for this residency in Stourbridge. And this fella, I remember him now, he's so many years ago, he may be dead. He was like an old counsellor or something. And he had an old suit on, this tie. And he looked up, he hadn't said anything. All the interview looked up, he said, we have better things to spend our money on in Stourbridge. And I said, right. I'll be off then. What a terrible thing. The rest of the panel looked at him askance. I remember that. And to this day, I can remember the kind of the defeated scrape my chair went. I stood up and went home from Stourbridge on about five trains. So that was one specific failure because I was cocky at that time. I thought, well, I'm bound to get this job in Stourbridge.
Yeah.
You know, Stourbridge. It's not like, it's not Barnsley. But then, just the way he said, we have better things to spend our money on, Stourbridge. And it was being, I think it was being, looking back, I sometimes think about it, I think well, it was being funny in a way, but at the time, as a young man, it is kind of crushing to be told that. So that's my first failure.
Yeah, it's a good one.
The second failure was, I've always worked in kind of community art settings, and I was working at a place called DARTS, Doncaster Community Arts in Doncaster, in the early 90s, that would be, and I still work there a bit now, and this building firm approached us and they said, look, we're building a new estate and they always call it things like Acacia Drive and some other street. Why don't you work with a group of children and get them to think of names for the street that go in a narrative? So that if you started at one end of the estate and walked all the way around it, you would get a story.
Wow, that's a lovely job.
I thought, what a great idea. What an imaginative idea. Mm. So me and this musician worked with this group of year six as they were in a junior school. And this, at the start of the session, nobody said anything. Then this lad suddenly went, St. Featherwell. And I went, St. Featherwell? Who's he? He said, well, they made this story about this saint who dropped a feather down a well. and this bird flew out the well. And we're going, wow. So we invented this thing that went like, St. Featherwell Street, bird down the well. And he didn't do any connecting words. It wasn't a street called And Later Avenue. But it made sense. And the idea was that you'd have a like an explaining board at the start of the start of the estate. Yeah. And so the kids were very excited and we wrote some songs and we had some junk percussion and we turned up and pretended to the builders, right, we've done this. And they said, oh, come and show us. So we had this meeting in this builder's office. There's all these builders sat there with suits. I can see that there's a continuation here. There's suits, they're all people in suits. the builders sat there, and we stood up and we did this presentation about St. Featherwell, and we sang and we held up kind of images of what the streets would look like. And there was this, at the end, there was this terrible silence. And this man went, "Well, that's been a failure, hasn't it?" And I went, "Has it?" He said, "Yeah, that's a complete failure." And he kept saying the word failure. And his mate said, "Yeah, bit of a flop."
And this is with the kids stood there as well.
Yeah, that was the worst thing. I said, "Look, you could have told us later or had a word or something," but no. So the kids were disappointed. I was disappointed. The building firm were disappointed. So that was it. And that was the one where you think, "Oh, well, I'm doing a good job. We're bridging some kind of gap. This is great. This is exciting. You're not working with the usual suspects." Mm. Here's some builders who've said, "Let's take a chance." And that failed. The third failure was a kind of a performing failure, because I've always enjoyed standing up in public and performing. Mm. And it mostly goes all right. But the ones you remember, the ones that don't.
Mm.
And years ago, me and my mate, the late, he's dead now, my brother-in-law, Martin Wiley, we used to go around doing poems and stories, just gentle stuff. Mm. And we were called Yakety Yak because we talked. And it was like just a spoken word thing. And we did a tour of village halls down in Somerset. And every night they'd go, "Look, you think it's good tonight? It's gone very well. Wait till Saturday night. Wait till High Ham. They'll love you in High Ham." And we get to High Ham, me and my mate, with our little books of poems. And there's a sign up that says, "Tonight, Yakety Yak, adult comedians." I said to the bloke, "Whatever we are, we're not adult comedians. We're just two fellas reading poems." He went, "Oh, I thought you were adult comedians. They're expecting adult comedians."
Bit of blue.
Bit of blue, Yakety. Blue Yak. I said, "We're not adult." He says, "Oh, you'll be fine. You'll be fine." So we stood up doing the stuff that normally gets laughs in a gentle setting, and nobody laughed. And there was like this silence. And then this bloke got up. He came to the front of the stage and he went, "I'm going to the toilet now. If you say something funny while I'm out, let me know."
Which was the biggest laugh everyone got that night.
It was the biggest laugh. People are cheering him because they were so relieved to hear something funny. So then I said to my mate, "We may as well go." So we went off the stage and the organiser came up and said, "Is that it?" I said, "Well, they don't like us." He said, "Well, all right." He said, "But can you go back on for the vote of thanks?" And that was a moment of failure. Because he went back on and said, "Well, they weren't exactly what we thought, but can you give a round of applause to Yakety Yak?" Then there was nothing. So that's an example of failure. And that's an example where, you know, if that had been my first ever gig, I would never have got up ever again.
Yeah.
But my solution to this is, I always tell to people who haven't done much of it before, I say, always think in geological time, because that moment when that fella said that was terrible. And maybe for a few weeks or months after it was terrible. I think about it now, you know, and I thought I'm going to talk to him about this. It still strikes a kind of fear into my heart. But in geological time, it doesn't matter. In geological time, in 100,000 years, who cares what they said in High Ham that night?
Mm.
So there's three examples of the many failures.
Do you know what's the terrible thing about that, particularly that second story? While you were telling that story, I'd completely forgot it was a story about failure. And I was all for it. I was sounded great, like a great idea. And the failure bit really, caught me. A glancing blow, that one.
We thought it would. You know, that was the thing. I think maybe that's one of the worst kinds of failures, isn't it? When sometimes you'll go to a place and you're going to do something like a workshop or a reading or work with people or something. And from the start, you think, this is going to be hard. It might not work. They're I once did a gig where a lot of sixth formers turned up with Ian McEwan books. Expecting Ian McEwan. And they're looking at me thinking, time's been hard for Ian McEwan. And I could see them. You know, I'm reading poems and trying to get a few laughs, and they were looking at me. And so you knew from the start, luckily they weren't all Ian McEwan fans, you know, so you knew from the start that wasn't going to work. But the Builders one, the Featherwell one, we thought it was going to work. And maybe in a sense that's the worst kind of failure where, you know, defeat is snatching the jaws of victory, as it were.
Do you find that as you're writing something, it's quite hard to tell whether what you're writing is any good or not at the time? Do you feel like you've got better at that over the years? Because obviously you're performing in front of people as well, so you get a reaction. Are you quite good now at knowing if something's going to hit or not?
You think you are. I think I am, but then you so often get it wrong. You think you write something and you think, God, that's the one, that's the line in the poem where I can take a breath because they'll be laughing so much.
Yeah.
That I've got time to go out and have a cup of tea and come back. And then you do the line and it doesn't get a laugh. Or sometimes somebody will ask you to write something and you'll do what you think is a good job. I remember somebody asked me to write something. It was a poem about birds and migration. And I sent it to him saying, look, this is a first draft and I can do some alterations if you want, but I think it's all right. And he wrote back this email, and all he said in the email was, a bit like Prince Charles when he met Liz Truss, he went, dear, oh dear. That was all he said in the email. And I went, have I got it wrong? He says, you've got it completely wrong. You have got this absolutely and completely wrong. And I'm going, my little voice, I'm going, it's only a draft. I'm sorry. Oh dear. So yes, sometimes you think something's all right and it's not.
Yeah.
And the proof of that is when somebody reads it or you read it yourself in front of an audience. I always think that for a piece that you're going to perform, the actual first performance of it is the final draft, because there'll be a line that you think looks great on the page, but it's really hard to say in front of people. You can say it in the house,
yeah,
but in front of a crowd, it's really hard. Yeah.
I suppose when you give something a couple of years and then reread it, you get a bit of objectivity as well.
Mm.
It's, you have proper blind spots, though, I think.
Oh, yes. You do. You think something's great. You write this thing, you think, God, that's good. That is really good. Then you're right, you return to it a couple of years later, you think, what youth wrote this? What callow youth would dribble these few drops on the page? Yes, you're right. And that's the good thing, isn't it? You know, you look back on your early poems and think, flipping heck, who was that lad? You know, and that's fine. That's good, isn't it? Because you think, you know, the 25-year-old isn't going to be the 67-year-old. You hope, you know.
How's your work changed over the years?
Well, I mean...
Has it got better or worse, would you say?
I don't know. It's got different, I tell you. You asked me to bring along some early poems, so I've got a poem.
Oh,
I've dug out my first book, and I've not looked at this book for years.
Oh, that's good.
It's called The Changing Problem. It was published by Carcanet Press in 1980.
Right.
Oh, nice.
So that's a long time ago. So I would be 24 when it came out.
Yeah. So this wasn't exactly... like first tentative forays into penning verses. This is that
true, but some of these were poems that had been in magazines like a long time before.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so they're quite old things.
They go back.
The thing I couldn't find, I was trying to find one that I'd published in the school magazine when I was about 13. Oh, I remember the title. I found the word zoismic in a book. It's some kind of, it's like a religion. And the poem was called Zoismic Poem. And I thought, God, I am so clever. Zoismic poem. It helped that I was the editor of the magazine. That's how I managed to get it in. And what I found was, with these poems, my two influences at that time were Dylan Thomas. I read so much Dylan Thomas. And he's dangerous to read when you're a teenager because of his kind of word drunkenness. You end up imitating him. Dylan Thomas and Ted Hughes. Mm. We had this book in the sixth form called Nine Modern Poets. And Dylan Thomas and Ted Hughes were two of the poets. And there were photographs of all the poets on the cover, but it didn't tell you who was who. So for years, this is true, I thought Ted Hughes looked like Philip Larkin. Then when you see an actual picture of Ted Hughes, you think, is he wearing a wig? Who is this poem? Anyway, so I haven't read these for years, so I'm going to pick one at random.
Oh, brilliant, okay.
And we'll just read it, and I might then die. And never be seen again.
Read it and weep, literally.
Oh.
We can discuss it and critique it together afterwards.
You can, yeah. Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Right, hang on, here we go. So, this is called Treatise, and it's on page 49. Scrooge's remarkable spiritual turnabout in the last chapter, compared to that man in overalls, hesitating at the door because he sees the steam and the boy waving his arms, scalding, making tea, makes sense when looked at in the light of the chip shop in Nairn, with the tiny man and the tracts and pamphlets all over the counter next to the pop and peanuts near the harbour. And you can see with that I'm trying to be kind of obscure. I mean, it's odd. I've read this. I've just read this. I haven't read this. I promise you, I haven't read this for years. What I do remember is when it goes, Scrooge's remarkable spiritual turnabout in the last chapter, compared to that man in overalls, I now remember that man in overalls is me. And I'm at the door of my little house that I used to live in when my wife and I were first married. and I'd left something on the cooker too long, and this bloke's waving his arms because the kitchen's on fire. Not drastically, but I remember that now. And then I do remember that what's not in the poem, which is probably a good thing, is my wife coming home from work and finding the kitchen on fire when I promised that I'd be sitting writing poems.
They hate that, wives, don't they?
Mm. Oh, they do. There's nothing worse than a kitchen on fire.
Yeah, they hate that.
God, but I'll tell you what, reading that, it's so strange. It is so strange that, you know, the bits I say wouldn't be a failure, I would say would be the way that the last chapter is the end of the first line, and then the last two lines in the poem, over the counter near the harbour, there's a kind of rhyme or chime with chapter and counter and harbour. But it's, I don't know, it's weird. It is, it's honestly very odd. Reading those.
It feels very stream of consciousness, that, because it doesn't feel the need to explain anything. It's just, it's almost like it's just what's going on in my head right now, and I'm going to say it.
I think I've always done that, you know. I've always reported on what was happening, even my new stuff. The American poet Elizabeth Bishop calls it the more successful surrealism of everyday life. You know, stuff just happens. That's why when I do my early morning stroll, I always tweet about it, and I tweet about what I see, and it's always the same stroll around the village. And I try and see something different each time, and it always rewards me. You know, I think that's what I've always done in a sense. And I think maybe not always, because maybe when I first started, I thought you had to make it profound is the word. But as in fact, as we know, just whatever happens, I think if you just write it down, it becomes interesting. So having looked at that, you think, well, look, I cannot remember the man in Nairn, the harbour and the counter, but there he was. He was a chap. And then, I mean, there's another one here that's like a four-liner. This feels more, it feels less obscure. It's called The One-Armed Man in the Pub. There are nine arms in this low room. An empty glass gapes like a sleeve. Across the table, I watch him light a cigarette. Precise hand jive. And that, I don't remember that, but that would have been something I saw.
Yeah, that's nice. I like that, hand jive.
And then I'm trying to... You can see me trying to be clever by saying there are nine arms in this low room and then an empty glass. And I was kind of keen on that rhyme of sleeve, half rhyme of sleeve and hand jive. This is very strange. I'll tell you what's another thing as well. I've actually signed it because my mother and dad aren't with us anymore. And it's the copy I signed to them. So it said July 1980 for mother and dad with love. And I've obviously got it back from their house, which is just across the road from where I am now, when they died in the early 2000s. Because Simon Armitage tells that story, doesn't he, of being outside a charity shop very early in the morning before the cafes were open. And there was a pile of books on the charity shop step. And he finds one and opens it, and it says, for mother and dad with love, from Simon. You know, at least they hadn't sent it to a charity shop.
Yeah.
So that is weird. And the other odd thing is I've signed the book with my full name, as though my mother and dad don't know my name. So I put Ian McMillan, for mother and dad with love.
That's in case they want to sell it when you get famous, you know.
That's right.
Yeah, oh, true.
What a strange thing. I'll tell you what, that was a very interesting experience, that was, for me, just opening that book. I just got it off the shelf downstairs. You know, there it is. Wow. 1980.
You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast, which hopefully means you quite like it. And if that's the case, would you be a love and tell others about it too? Or I'll send my boys round and duff you up. Thank you.
Do all your poems, or like the ideas for them, do they just come to you when you're going about your business? That's what it sounds like. Or do you ever actually like sit down with a blank sheet of paper and go, right, poetry time?
Well, there's two kinds, aren't there? There's the ones that things just happen to me and I write them down. Then there's the other kind where I'm lucky enough to be asked to write poems.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you get commissioned. So at the moment, I am battling through writing a Yorkshire dialect translation of The Barber of Seville.
Right. Wow.
That well-known opera.
Is this for a new building estate in Rotherham, doing the roads?
It is. That's the one. We're going to sing it, and they're going to go, you failed again. The sons and daughters of those people told us it was rubbish. You're back again here. It's rubbish again. I met this composer called Alan Williams, who, when I'm over in Salford doing The Verb, he teaches at Salford Uni. And he said, oh, I'm a composer. So we met up and we had this disconcerting conversation where I said, what kind of music do you write then? He went, oh, the usual.
Okay.
That's good. But then it turned out he, like me, was very interested in dialect. So we wrote a Yorkshire dialect opera just to see if the operatic long note could hold the flat vowel of Yorkshire. And it can. You know, she kind of go, la la.
We're having a natter with Macmillan. It is more of a chat than a grilling about the jobs that went smooth as Belgian chocolate, but also the times when he cocked up. There's the time he named streets on the map, but the builder thought it were crap. If your client is looking at you weirdly, 'cause they think that you've wasted the time, but you reckon that the job you've done is gradely, and that your client's just an horrible little swine, just think of geological time.
So we did a bit, and it's that bit that goes, Figaro, Figaro, Figaro. We did about 8 minutes worth, and we did a little showcase of it in about the end of 2019. It seemed all right. And then they said, all right, we'll get some money from somewhere and we'll write the whole thing. I went, all right. And then the pandemic happened. So I had my AGM with my agent, Adrian. And we said, what do you think has happened to the Barber of Seville? He said, I think that's bit the dust. That's gone. I said, yeah, I think you're right. We haven't heard from him for a couple of years. Then when he got home, there was an email from him saying, we've got the money. Let's do the Barber of Seville in Yorkshire dialect. Can we do it by July 2023? There you go. All right. And you get the score out, and it's about 300 pages. So anyway, that's what I'm battling away at. So there's that kind of thing where you get asked to write it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that frees up your mind to do the things that you haven't been asked to do. So while today I've been tapping away at the Barber of Seville, you know, other things have been floating through my head, kind of unbidden. So a lot of the poems I write these days are just, I did this, I did that. I've got my latest pamphlet. It's called Yes, But What Is This? What Exactly? Which I heard somebody say on a bus. They were looking at something and he said, Yes, but what is this? What exactly? So I thought, I'm going to call a book that.
Do you have any of those poems there with you, Ian? Could you share one with us now?
Mm. Yeah, of course I'll do that. This is probably more worked on than some of them are, but this is just when I'm on a train and you pass a cricket pitch, your ambition is always to see a wicket taken. And when you're on a train and you pass a football match, your ambition is always to see a goal scored. And this is me on the bus. And this is just something that happened, so I kind of wrote it down. So it's called Seeing a Goal Scored from a Passing Train. I like titles like that because they set you up for what's going to happen. You know, either the titles like that, or you could call it, you know, After the Anvil Fell. You know, so then, and it would be like it would send you up some kind of garden path. The train slows, almost stops. Drizzle's stories are stale and repetitious, and the traveller wipes a hole in the window steam with his sleeve. A goal is a brief moment of clarity, a punctuation mark in a game's long sentence. A match is happening on a soggily diluted field. Men and boys run through sludge to get, well, where? To the future celebration, obvs. A goal is a point of sudden change, a new route found on an old map. A bloke who looks like he's made of mud, boots the ball so hard that the air, the very air it travels through, almost breaks. A goal is a memory you always knew you'd have, even before the goal was scored. The keeper flaps like a scarf in a breeze, wafts nothing except the ball's ghost, and the striker runs away, mouth open in joy. The goal is always the goal of the game and the goal of the season until the next goal. I stand and whoop, and the train's dullards stare at me like I'm a cave painting come to life. I don't care. It's a goal. The train creaks, moves. So that was just me, like, saw this goal. Then I did actually stand up and go, yes! Why not? Yeah. So that's the difference, you know, that I'm kind of flogging away at the Barber of Seville, which I'm enjoying, but it's taking up a certain part of my head. And then that means another bit of your head is free to drift about, find things, I think.
Interesting. I want to go back to Yorkshire dialect, because I know that you wrote a book called Chelp and Chunter.
Chelp and Chunter, yes.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's your favourite Yorkshire word or phrase?
My favourite Yorkshire word is brussen. Brussen is a bit brussen. And it's kind of untranslatable. And it means, He's a bit oppositional. He's a bit rough. He's a bit maddy. He's got something against what you're about to tell him. He's right brushing. I love all dialects, and I love the range of Yorkshire dialects. How different they all are.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that one. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, Brusson, a word that don't travel far outside Barnsley. Yor. What you're doing? And it means you. I've seen Yor. Why are you? It's great. And I'm unusual. I often say that I'm unusual because I make my living through talking. And a lot of Barnsley men, they're not great talkers. You know, there's a lot of, all right. Not wasting the breath.
Just vowels, mostly.
Just vowels. Nobody's ever said a consonant in Barnsley since, what, 1994? What's he's using consonants on us? But yes, I mean, I love all dialect. I think it's, and the more of it, the better. And Yorkshire's got such a range of them. I love it when you go to Hull and they go, this skern tastes like a stern. I've got all Stern Razors albums. But just anywhere. I did a radio series once about pies. I was paid by the BBC to eat pies.
Wow.
And it was great. 6:15 is about different pies. And I wanted to call the series Crust Almighty. But because it went out on a Sunday, we weren't allowed. So we had to call it Who Ate All the Pies. And we went all over the country and went to Dundee, where they have those horrible Scotch pies called a pear. And apparently, if you want a pie, you call it a pear. And if you want an onion pie, you go, I'll hear a pear. And an onion, yin, and ya. So I got mic'd up with this secret mic. And at the job, my job was to go into this shop and go, I'll hear a pear. And an onion, yin, and ya. So I went in and I went, I'll hear a pear. And an onion, yin, and ya. And the woman went, you're not from Dundee. I said, no. How did you guess?
I love the word gradely. That's one of my favourites.
Gradely's good, isn't it? And gradely's kind of, it's disappearing, you know. It don't get said very often.
Yeah, you don't hear it very often. It was mostly older men who would say, it's right, gradely that.
Gradely. And the other interesting one for me is reet versus rate. So we say rate in South Yorkshire, and reet is a West Yorkshire thing. It's reet, rate. I love it. It's what linguists call an isogloss. When language changes in a small geographical space. So there'll be a reet, rate, isogloss somewhere, from where I am in Barnsley, somewhere around Denby Dale, they'd probably say reet. And it's endlessly fascinating. And people think it's dying out, and it's not. It's just growing and living, you know, like language does.
You got any, Tom?
I remember playing cricket. Mm. So I grew up in Huddersfield and going over to play in Barnsley, and we couldn't understand a word they were saying.
Right.
That's not really that far either, is it?
It's not far. But that's the thing. Huddersfield, it is the West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire thing.
Yeah.
There's that wonderful, is it, do you know the Huddersfield phrase, leek geen? Is leek geen?
No.
That ended up in my dialect book. It means he's a bit dodgy. He's like light, he's kind of from light given or light born. He's a bit odd, a bit strange. The thing about the dialect book was, it's another one of those examples where you say yes. Collins, I think it was, Collins Dictionaries had started this series where they were going to get lots of writers to make dictionaries. And they asked me, and I was kind of flattered. I thought, yes, I can do this. And I like the idea of, because it's a dictionary, somebody would say, oh, yes, just get the Macmillan down from the shelf. And I said, because it's my dictionary, am I allowed to make a word up and put it in the book? Because then when a word gets put in the book, it becomes sacred. He said, yeah, you can do that. So I invented the word griddled, which is the art of weeing down a grate when you've had 15 pints.
Yeah.
So it's in the book. And it's great because now people go, that word griddle, oh, it's in the Macmillan. I'll just get the Macmillan down from the show.
I mean, all words are made up, aren't they?
Mm. Exactly.
Tom's got a word, haven't you, Tommy?
I made up a word. It's never really caught on. Yeah. My word is enthricing.
Enthricing? Yeah. Like enticing, but three times?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, very much so. It's enthralling and enticing.
What a great word.
Use it. Please do it, because it needs... I've been trying to release it into the wild for about 20 years now.
I'll use it. It's
just got no traction. But
as you know, people say things like, he's broken the rules of grammar. And you go, whose rules are these again?
Yeah.
Who's made them up? You know, I love it when the apostrophe police descend on you. And they go, I know where the apostrophe goes in tomatoes. And you go, well, first of all, get a life. Secondly, nobody dies. Thirdly, they're dying out anyway. Fourthly, they're not rules, the conventions. You know, on Twitter, people go, oh, I could kill that person who put the apostrophe in the wrong place. And you go, don't be silly.
We've had the apostrophe police on this show.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
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 What were they like?
Well, he's a friend of mine.
All right.
So I think that answers your question, Ian.
Yeah, that's right. It was great. It was a lovely guy.
It's a smashing lad. He wrote a book called Fucking Apostrophes. So he is kind of making a joke about the fact that they are really annoying.
I think the thing is that they're going to die out soon because people use them in different ways so often. I think in the end, they're just going to go. And they'll be found. There'll be loads of them like tadpoles. Found like ages.
Yeah, yeah.
What are these? Oh, they're old apostrophes. You don't want to know.
Oh, they're breeding.
Thousands made jobless as the apostrophe factory shuts down.
Thousand apostrophe S. Apostrophe S. I always do. Me and my mate wrote a song called Apostrophe Amnesty Day. And when we did gigs around Village Halls, I'd get the flip chart out. And we used to make songs up with the audience with a flip chart. And I'd put, it's apostrophe amnesty, and I'd put APO, apostrophe, like put loads of apostrophes in the word apostrophe. And you could see people in the audience going, and they had to sing, it's apostrophe, amnesty day, throw in a comma, don't let it get in the way. You could see some of them were singing it through gritted teeth. That's not the word.
Catapostrophe, which is portmanteau of catastrophe and apostrophe. I imagine there's a factory just outside a ring road in a northern town. Been there for ages and a day. They don't make bikes or windows or spoons or shoes or stools or tools or calendars of dogs wearing clothes. There's a terrier wearing a beret in May. And July's a gilleted dachshund, by the way. They, the factory, not the dogs, make those floaty commas no one seems to know how to use these days. Of course, in the good old times, they used to be used in places quite prescriptive. Ah, yes, ye goody olden days when the linguistic boundaries of English were rather less predictive. It was old Willie S. who decided that the county's galleys got possessive, with flying punctuation chucked in and over. But in recent times, the old inverted comma appears to have slowly slipped into a coma. Outraged of Winchester screams from the local rag, and at SausageHunter75 bleats on tweets, getting apoplectic when participles are scrambled, sentences ramble, angels spelt angles, before the worst crime of all, the humble apostrophe, or lack thereof, or misplacedness of, drives them round the bend and up the wall. They furiously critique signs with a surplus, menus with missing and plurals possessed by ghosts of missed grammar lessons. How many butchers' dogs are there exactly? It's not clear. How many butchers are even here? Who gives a shite? But like a giddy white-knuckled child with a birthday balloon, they can't let go of those floating grammatically functional delights. Just imagine the carnage if they vanish completely, they shout to the world or anyone who would listen. I mean, I agree. All wouldn't be well when I'll became ill. Although some would when Will drops it, still. It would put Mr. and Mrs. Diath in a deadly position. And what for those workers in the imagined apostrophe mill? They'll be out of a job. What will they do with their day? Maybe flip them and sell them as commas. Slip them into semicolons. Cobble the buggers together for speech marks, they'd say. Or maybe we sit back and go with how it goes and accept language does what it wills, whether you like it or not. And there's nothing we can do to punctuate the evolution. Full stop.
So I wanted to get onto your latest book, Ian.
Mm-hmm.
My Sand Life, My Pebble Life.
Oh, yes.
Which is less a book of verse, more of a memoir of your time spent by the sea over the years.
Yes, it is. I mean, what happened was, it's again a case of saying yes when somebody rings you up, because the publisher who did this book rang up and said, look, we've got a book, somebody's written a book about the coast. Would you like to write an introduction to it? I said, yes, I can. They said 1,000 words. And I like that. 1,000 words is a good length. I said, yeah, I can write that. So I wrote this introduction, and they went, we like this introduction. Would you like to write a book about the coast? And the previous two books I'd written were a thing called Neither Note Nor Summit, which was a kind of autobiography, and then a book about Barnsley called Real Barnsley. And between you and me, it had nearly killed me writing these books. I'm all right, I can write short things, but at the end of them, I went, I'm going to write no more books ever again, ever, 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 ever. And then my wife said, you know, because you've always been freelance, you always say yes. So then they rang up and said, would you like to write this book about the coast? And my wife could see me trying to say the word no.
Trying to form the end.
And she's like, like moving a hand across her throat with Senno. And I'm going, no. And I went, look, all right. I said, all right, I'll have a go. I'll have a go. And then I thought, well, actually, it could be interesting because what I'll do is I'll do a gig in a village hall, and whatever that village hall is, I'll stay over and I'll go to the nearest bit of coast and write about it. Mm. I thought that'll work. And then I said to the publisher, look, I'm no good at writing enormous bits of prose. I said, how many words do you want? He said, it's not that long. It's 50,000. So it's not like an 80,000 word book. It's 50,000 words. I said, what? All different? He went, well, more or less. So I said, all right, how about then if I write you 50 1,000 word bits about the coast? And they went, all right. I said, so I'm going to go to 50 different bits of the coast and write about it. They went, let's do that. And then as soon as we'd said yes, the pandemic happened and everything stopped and I couldn't go anywhere. And I was sat in this room that I'm sat in now. And I rang the publisher and they said, well, we still like to do it. I said, well, I can't. I'm not allowed to go to the coast. And when I am allowed to go to the coast, whenever that is, I guess it'll be deserted. I'll be walking about in a mask. It'll be more about the pandemic than it is about the coast. Mm. So I said, how about if I start, because we didn't know how long it was going to last, how about if I start writing some memories of the coast? And they went, all right. So that was my lockdown project. Every morning, I'd get up and I'd go downstairs and do my stroll when I was allowed. Then I'd come up to this little room that I'm in now and I'd sit down and I'd dredge out another memory of the coast. And honestly, I'd sit there. You know what it's like when you write about memory? You'd sit there and you go, I can't remember much about that, but wait a minute, yeah, that's coming back to me. What about when that happened? And so eventually I wrote these 50 1,000 word bits about the coast. And there were two threads going through it, really. There was memory, and there was also my mother-in-law, who died just very recently, but her thing was her caravan at Cleethorpes. And once you were unlocked, she was allowed to go to her caravan. So there's a thread about that. And I found it interesting. I did enjoy writing it. And then they said, do you fancy writing a few poems to go in the middle? And I went, all right. And at the time, when lockdown started, Barnsley Museums made me their poet in lockdown, which led to some fantastic heckling. When I'd be walking down the street, people would shout, that should be locked up, not locked down. A man shouted from a car. But the idea was, I thought, well, I'll have a go at writing some sonnets, because a sonnet is me rhyming in my old age. A sonnet is a kind of technical exercise so that people can have a go at writing a sonnet. And so we had a kind of sonnet explosion in Barnsley. So I thought, all right, I'll write some sonnets about the coast. And that's what I did. So in the middle of the book, there are some sonnets. Mm. And I did enjoy writing it. But what I found out was I was trying to be sometimes in the book a bit too poetic. I think it was a result of tweeting a lot. Because in a tweet, you're going to try and do a gag or an image. You know, so I remember being really proud of this tweet I did once where I'm on a train and I said, there's a crow in a tree like a goth in a bedsit. And I thought, oh, that's a nice image. You know, it's just an image that works on its own. Or you do a gag like a shore, my anagram for a horse. Just a little gag that only works, and it works because it's concentrated. And I found when the book was published, the one thing that did disappoint me was I thought, oh, I've tried to add on some of these sentences. You know, I've tried to make each one light and heat an entire town, you know, rather than some of the sentences could just have been not placeholders exactly, but places where the paragraph might rev up towards the next sentence. But I think I've ended up kind of making it too, I don't know, too shiny, I suppose. But yeah, I did enjoy writing.
Well, I didn't get that impression, Ian, from reading the book.
Well, I mean, I think whenever the book or whatever's finished, you always want to say, can I just have it back and just do a bit more, please? Yeah. And I had no idea how to end it. I mean, you've seen the book. The ending was me and my mate Luke doing a gig in Workington and being at the top of this hill. And my idea was that he would play some tune and I would make something up. Then right at the end, I just play with that phrase, my sand life, my pebble life, and just
kind of fade out.
Had bits of it fading out. And when I did a bit of some readings to promote the book, I didn't know how to do that. So I kept just doing it, missing bits out. So it sounded like my microphone had broke.
That was like an old Norman Collier skit.
Norman Collier, exactly.
I really enjoyed it. It's
good, thank you.
I think for anyone who spent time as a kid on UK beaches, you know, tucked behind windbreakers, and eating your packed lunch with sand in it. It just had that very sort of nostalgic feel. Oh, good.
That was what I was aiming at. Definitely. Yeah. It would have been a different book if the pandemic hadn't happened. That's a fact, because I would have been up and about.
It'd be less memory. Yeah.
It would, and it'd be more like when you have to write a travel bit. If somebody rings up and says, can you write me 100 words about going somewhere? You know, you would.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd all be kind of flashy surface, as it were. Whereas at least with this, I had more time to reflect. You're right, yeah.
Mm. Do you have a favourite seaside memory from all the ones in the book?
Yes, I do. It's we were in Wales, me and my mother and dad, my brother, and we'd walked up this hill in Wales, and we'd looked out to sea, and then we'd started walking back down. And my mother was very proud of this watch that she'd got. And we're walking back down. On the way down, we came across these elderly men in suits. Suits, again. Elderly men in suits carrying a woman. And it turned out the woman had broken a leg. And these were elderly chapel men trying their best to carry her back down to the chapel, because these were like a Welsh chapel, a Welsh-speaking chapel, who'd gone for a walk up this hill that they did every year. And this woman had fallen down and broken her leg. So my dad and my uncle Jack helped them to carry this woman down. And I remember we went to this chapel in sight of the sea, and we had Welsh cakes and tea. And then I remember my dad saying, we'd better get back to the Tanny Marianne guest house where we're staying. And my mother looked at her watch, or where her watch was, and it turned out she'd left her watch at the top of the hill. And my dad and my Uncle Jack said, well, we've been up once and twice, we're not going back. So then at the end of it, I just imagined this watch still there, you know, ticking its English tick, I think I put. And that was a memory. And that was one of those memories that actually dredged itself up as I was writing the book. You know, so I've been thinking about, there's quite a bit in it about, we went to a place like Llandudno and that bit of North Wales.
Yeah.
And then I remember just writing something else, and then suddenly this image of my mother's watch. And then all the rest of it was pulled out, like on a thread. So that was one of my favourite bits. The other favourite bit was me and the lads, as we called ourselves, going to my mate's house in Blackpool and promising each other we'd walk to the beach with nothing on our feet.
Oh, yeah.
And we end up at the beach and just like cut to ribbons. And we persuaded our parents to let us go and see the play Hair, because we said it was about barbers. And it was, in fact, like naked men and women running about. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. The gag in that one was that we said, we're going to walk to the beach in Blackpool and see the sunrise. We said, yes, we'll do that. We'll walk to the beach. Here we are walking like pilgrims with bleeding feet towards the beach. And me and the lads are going, getting light, weirdly, but we can't see the sun. Something strange must be happening when you get there. And, of course, all the people who've read the bit realise, because they're cleverer than us, that Blackpool's in the west and the sun rises in the east. And so at the end of the piece, I put, you know, we just realised that the sun rising in the west when we all sat watching Hair. There's a bloke with his bum up in the air, you know. And that was I made that bit up, to be honest, but I just thought that would be interesting. And that is true, that we were so daft that we couldn't realise why we couldn't see the sun rising. Oh, dear me.
Oh, that's nice.
Ian, before we let you go, can I ask you the big serious question before we end, if that's all right?
Of course, yeah, please.
What do you think the point of poetry is?
I think it's to make us remember, or make us realise, that we are human beings and that we are creative beings. You know, and so my little 8-month-old grandson, Louis, he'll be laughing, he'll be crying, and he'll be making rhythmic language, mainly out of vowels, you know, but it'll be a language that is him responding to the world and making it his own. I think that's what poetry does, you know, it makes you realise that you're human, and it makes you also realise, which goes right back to my school days, that you can do it, that everybody can do it, and that we can all make it our own, and it's not an exclusive thing. So that's what I think the point is, just to remind us that we're human and that we can all have a go at it.
Yeah, well, that's bloody beautiful.
Nice answer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ian, for hanging out with us.
I enjoyed that very much. Very enjoyable. I really did.
Fantastic. We'll drop a link to My Sand Life, My Pebble Life, and obviously a link to The Verb. We didn't talk about The Verb. I wanted to talk about The Verb, but another time.
Yeah.
I was also going to ask you, Ian, can we send you a T-shirt? Can we send you a Failing Writers T-shirt?
Of course. Thank you. Yeah, send that and I'll wear it and I'll...
Oh, bless you.
Definitely. Thank
you.
Yeah, definitely. Really
cool. And what size would you like?
I would say large. Years ago, it used to be extra large, but I've lost quite a lot of weight, so I think large would be all right.
Excellent.
That reminds me of a bit, as a brilliant description of you on a beach. And there's like an Adonis-bodied father on the beach playing frisbee with his son. And you describe him, and then you describe yourself, and you say, "I've slimmed down a bit now. I was quite a unit. I took up quite a bit of North Norfolk." I think is how you describe it. I thought that was brilliant. Fantastic. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Really enjoyed that.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Bye.
What a wonderful man.
Yes.
What a wonderful storyteller.
Yes.
Isn't he?
Can we call it living legend? Is that too,
I think,
is that
so
too strong?
We'll check up on him and check he's still alive, but yes.
Yeah, that was excellent. Thank you, Ian. Thanks for hanging out with us. It was very nice.
And all this poetry chit-chat, it's ended up being quite a poetry-themed episode, this, in the end. As I mentioned earlier, the surprise little thing is another poetry thing, isn't it? It's poets all around.
It is.
And it got us thinking about different kinds of poetry, and in particular, the limerick, because it is around this time, is National Limerick Day, isn't
it? That is correct. When is it? I think it's the 12th of May, National Limerick Day. Yeah, 12th of May. Marking Edward Lear's birthday.
Ah, right, well, that would make sense. Mm. But yeah, so that got us thinking, and we're actually going to put together a little limerick special next week as a little cheeky in-between episode.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty highbrow limerick documentary. And we thought it'd be fun to set ourselves a bit of a task, as we do like to now and again, to write some limericks.
Yes, but we'd also like to invite you lot to write some limericks as well.
Everyone's got to enjoy doing a limerick, haven't they?
Yeah.
Even if you're busy on something else.
Yeah.
What a great excuse just to stop for a bit and do something silly.
Exactly.
And funny and fun.
And they can be about anything. They can be clean, they can be dirty, philosophical, stupid, whatever tickles your fancy.
Philosophically dirty. Yeah,
combine the two.
Existential smut. Yep. Oh, that's all good, isn't it? I tell you, we know what we should do as well. We should try and rope in currently missing pod member Dave.
That would be good.
This is so far up his street,
this is
isn't it?
Right up his alley.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
There was a young man called Dave, blah, 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 whose limericks were up his alley. Make it rhyme, and that's your limerick. He would love it. We'll have to get Dave involved.
Definitely.
And so after our highbrow limerick documentary, we'll
go very lowbrow.
amazing limericks.
And get them to us before Thursday, the 18th of May. And we'll feature them in the episode, if they're good, obviously.
I mean, if they're bad, we might do, just to have a laugh at them, might we?
Yeah, to make ours seem
that
better.
Be good. Yeah, a bit of contrast.
We'll put them in.
That might be a good thing.
So email us at failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com, or you can go to our website, failingwriterspodcast.com, and send it to us there. You can contact us on the website or on our email. Have we got anything else, Tom? Is there anything else? Should we wrap it up there? Or is there anything else?
More.
What?
More? As part of our ongoing community...
outreach program, yeah.
Yeah, we said we would, if people were stupid enough to send in their work, that we, for some reason, completely unqualified and not to be trusted with this sort of thing, would offer our view on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the next person that did that was David Lucas.
Mm.
And he sent in, well, it's quite nice what he sent in because it's quite short. So it wasn't a lot to read. It's like a prologue, isn't it?
It is.
And also, fantastically, a log line.
Yes.
I like it when people send a log line.
Yeah, that is nice.
And I think it showed, do you know, it made me, I know this is obviously literally the point of a log line, but it really does make you realise how the log line has to work, doesn't it? And as soon as you're reading it, you go, right, yeah, cool, that works. It just distills everything down. And it just shows that whatever you're doing, pretty much whatever kind of fiction you're writing, doing a log line's worth its weight in gold, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah. It should almost like start giving you ideas, shouldn't it? I mean,
lots of, well, what ifs? Oh, this, and then,
Get a flavour of,
Where's the friction coming from and everything?
We should say the title of his book. It's called Kicking the Embers.
Yeah.
Do you want to read his log line, Tommy?
Struggling writer Sam Rubicon gets a $500,000 offer to write an old Vietnamese soldier's life story, only to discover he risked becoming an accomplice in an act of war that put his career, his truth, and his life on the line.
Shall we hear a bit first?
Yeah.
Prologue, November 2008. From the doorway of his hospital room, I can see the end of Lan's bed. His 2 feet are poking out. His exposed, unburnt feet in the white antiseptic room are a smudge on an otherwise clean sheet of copy paper. The busy nurse has disappeared. Now my tension crumples into hesitation. What if he's awake? What do I say? He'll resent my presence. We'll struggle under an obligation neither of us wants to fulfill. Mr. Lan? He doesn't move. I slowly follow my better intentions into the room. Above the sheet, his torso, arms, and head are entirely bandaged. For a happy moment, I imagine it could be someone else. Then his feet steal my attention back. They are unmistakably his. In the 8 months I've known him, he's never worn anything but the same dirty flip-flops. Impossibly, he's kicked out of the sheets. Those 10 grizzled toes have lived their lives exposed to the elements. Once they led the way, now they reach for the heavens. Despite having seen them many times, this is my first opportunity to examine them closely. They are hideous, remarkable. Each one has a story to tell. Pain, betrayal, hunger, jealousy, war, escape, and another war or two for good measure. These are the tragedies familiar to most people who lived in Vietnam during the 20th century. Exposed to relentless sun and pounding rain, they've endured the muck of the paddy field and the unforgiving concrete of progress. By the time he arrived in New York, he could have afforded actual shoes, but toes like this would never accept confinement. Their demeanor, rising up at the end of the bed, speak of constant vigilance, even as their owner lies unconscious in the limbo of a medically induced coma. I'm safe. My moral duty can be fulfilled without being monitored by his withering and impassive eyes. But instead of fleeing the scene, I sit down and pull out my laptop like a compliant student. The soft plastic of the chair wheezes under me. It's a little too low, which is good. I'm out of sight of his mummified head, but his feet regard me expectantly. I stare back with an insolence I'd never dare use to his face. No, you're right. His voice penetrates me with absolute clarity. I can read his expression in the dirt baked into his soul. It's impossible that every inch of him didn't get a thorough disinfecting, but it's the type of dirt that builds over the decades, black from the New York subway and city streets. Under that layer would be the red dust of Saigon, packed tight into the cracks, making the jagged edges of old wounds smooth. Beneath that, a forensic investigation would discover traces of mud and fertilizer from the iconic paddy fields of Vietnam. So, how about that, Tommy?
Yeah.
Obviously, you've read all of it, and that was just a little taster.
Yeah. But yeah, what did you think?
What did I think? First thought, I thought he writes good prose. He's got a good...
Just don't know, it's very solid, isn't
yeah.
it? Like, almost, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but quite old-fashioned, quite like...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Just really like... Well structured, but it's not trying too hard. It just kind of breezes along at its own pace.
Yeah, he's got a good grasp, hasn't he, of language and flow and whatever. I'll tell you what really stood out for me. I thought it was a lovely idea to focus on the feet of the old man.
Yeah,
and that being like the thing that drew out his character.
Yeah.
I really like that. It was sort of weirdly moving.
It made it quite filmic as well, I think.
It is, yeah. It's like that zooming in on the...
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly
on
that.
The little thing to reveal a bigger idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the layers of dust on his feet and the toughness.
And that was almost like a close-up for me. Like you say there, it's kind of, you could feel it kind of hyper-focus on it, yeah.
Some nice metaphors going on with the feet and very sensitively delivered. And despite one of the characters not even being conscious, you already have like a sense of the relationship between the two characters, if you know what I mean. And you sort of pick up the idea that it's not entirely amicable. You know, he's clearly intimidated, isn't he? By him.
I say, there's definitely a power dynamic, isn't there? In that's not balanced.
Even though he's not awake.
Yeah.
And that's not an easy thing to set up, especially if one of them, you know.
It's not without being very easy to go far too much into the over-explaining side of things and kind of nodding to the audience and going, do you see? Because do you get this? But he doesn't, does he? He kind of just stands back from that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Just feeds in all the little bits bit by bit.
By talking about his feet, mainly.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really nice. I might have even pushed that a bit more. I might be tempted. I'm not telling you what to do, by the way, David. I'm just saying what I might have done is almost like had a guy have a conversation with somebody's feet or something. I don't know. Like even pushed it a bit.
Actually, I've just realised. You know, I was saying we're not qualified to do this. I've just realised this is, yeah, brilliant. Now he knows exactly what not to do. So, David, what you need to do is steer clear of
whatever you do,
an in-depth conversation with someone's foot. Brilliant. This is why it works. I've got it.
Yeah, yeah. It's really useful,
isn't it?
This little section.
Yeah. But I could imagine that being a really, one of these books that wins a big award type thing, you know, for the content.
Don't get him excited. You're getting him way excited.
Guaranteed to win something this, David. Get it in. Get it finished.
I've got a couple of things that aren't so much criticisms, they're questions, because obviously I'm not qualified to criticise apart from anything else. But the first thing that I was like, oh, that's interesting. It was about the genre, right? Because the piece reads like sort of literary fiction.
Yeah.
It's unhurried in its setting up the characters and everything. There's a lot of information. It's kind of unraveling quite gently. But I thought the log line made the book sound like a thriller or something, a bit more fast paced. Do you know what I mean? So if it was me and I'm thinking about querying this, I would think about the expectation the reader has. Do you know what I mean? If you read that log line first, you're going to read the piece and go, well, hang on, it's not very... Do you know what I'm trying to say? It's almost like in the log line, you need to set it up like it's not going to be...
You mean the log line sounds a little bit Hollywood movie, boom, bang,
yeah,
whoa,
exactly.
Whoosh.
Yeah. It's like there's this huge risk that he's going to get whisked into this terrifying world.
I see what you mean, but I think
where his life's on the line, and it's very in your face, isn't it?
But do you not think that's going to be a slow building, everything slowly getting bigger?
Well, it could, but I think if you're promising a thriller, you're going to disappoint people with this. Whereas if your logline is a bit more about the character, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like this is this character and he's thinking about these things, then you're not going into this expecting it to be like a chase scene or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I was just, oh, it's not a thriller was what I was thinking. It's an expectation thing, isn't it? It's almost like you do need to think about what people are sort of expecting on the other end.
Yeah, and maybe it brings into question of to prologue or not to prologue and where that sits within a... Because obviously you want your first chapter to be kicking into the action.
If it is a literary...
Even jumping ahead and being in the fulcrum of the action and coming back out of it.
That's it.
Whereas a prologue doesn't need that, does it? A prologue is very much about setting your stall out.
So I thought that was a question, but one that you could easily answer, I think.
Yeah.
But the other thing was the voice. Because, interestingly, because it's mostly first-person present tense, as though it's all happening right now. Do you know what I mean? That's the tense it's in. Although the tense just does change at the end to past tense. But the language is very considered, if that makes sense, rather than it's sort of springing into his head right now. So if you're doing first person present tense, it's like it's all happening to you and you're reflecting on everything that's happening. But the language felt like almost like he'd thought about it a bit more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can.
It took me out of this is happening now land, and it was more like a sort of omniscient narrator voice. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is, and I know I'm being finickety, but if this is the first bit a potential agent is going to read, I think it maybe either makes sense to for him to be reliving this in the past and explaining things a bit more, you know, reflecting and narrating and, you know, being more explainy, or you have it in the present tense. And it's more like a kind of stream of consciousness.
A bit messier and a bit more real.
Yeah, just a bit more loose. But it's sort of not, I don't know, it just felt like the wrong tense for that kind of voice. And it is finickety. But then you think, well, you're giving it to an agent.
He's been stupid enough to send it to us to ask what we think. So tough luck, David. Do you know what I mean?
But there's nothing, that's the thing, there's nothing wrong with the actual words, if you like. It was more just that, well, you put it in the present tense, it's like, I don't know.
It's no, not. It's just, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, question, like, have another look and think, do you think it would work better in another tense, or I'm probably talking rubbish? But there you go, that was my little thought.
Ooh.
On it.
Brilliant.
Ooh, is that a bit brutal?
I would hope you're trying to be helpful.
Well, that's what I am trying to be helpful. And they are very minor things, I think. Do you know what I mean? It's not like the language is bad or... And I did want to read more, and I think that's...
Yes, I thought that was... I mean, obviously, that's always the thing, isn't it? Are you bothered and do you want to read more?
And I like the sound of the concept. I think that's the thing. It's just like little finickety things more than anything.
Which may very well be answered with the rest
exactly.
of
that is very
the book
true.
Or further chapters. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Good point.
Well, there we go then. That's another great job done there. Well done us. Thank you, David Lucas.
Yeah, thanks, man. That was it's brave to send us stuff.
I liked it. I like what you did, David. So it's not all bad news.
Yeah, I like doing this. Please keep sending his work. I think it's fascinating. I think
people get bored, don't they, with hearing back from professional editors and people who know what they're doing. That doesn't give you a full picture,
exactly.
does it?
But I, the more stuff you read, I mean, it's like anything. Isn't it? The more books you read, the more you realise, you know, what works, what doesn't work. What I really like about this is that I think it makes us all think harder about how we write. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
If
yeah.
you dare to share, do it.
So, yeah, what we promised was, at the start, a little surprise. So on Twitter the other day, there was a post from a poet called David Wheatley. And he posted some pictures of a very empty traditional village hall.
Mm.
It couldn't be more village hall looking-y, to be honest. Had the chairs stacked at one end.
The school chairs.
Yeah, there's like a trestle table there, cream-painted walls. It is very, very... church hall, school hall, village hall. Anyway, he'd been invited, I think, or chosen to do a poetry reading there. And he posted a tweet saying, "Well, literally no one turned up for my poetry reading. Someone from the toddler group in the room next door did come in and give me a biscuit. So perhaps all is not lost." Now, we don't have any biscuits to offer. And I would imagine our audience is only slightly larger than an empty village hall. But we thought it'd be nice to invite David on to share a poem with us. So, David Wheatley, you posted a little forlorn tweet saying you put on a poetry performance. And how many people turned up?
Well, nobody turned up, as it happened. There was somebody who had to open the room up. You say I put it on. Well, I was kindly invited to do so. So I turned up out of the goodness of my heart. There was a toddler group next door in the village hall, which I can almost, if not quite, see out the window at the moment. It's a rather dreich evening, as we say in Aberdeenshire. It's very overcast and cloudy and dark and wet. So, you know, it's like that up here quite a lot. And I think maybe people wisely, very wisely, stay within the sanctity of their homes.
Now, I'm assuming, because you've got a pretty good track record in the old poetry, haven't you? That is this the first time that's happened to you? I assume you must have had much more successful readings.
I have had people say that anything with more people in the audience stand on stage counts as a success. But I think I've come fairly close to breaking that rule on more than one occasion in the past. So I can't even put this down as a one-off or a freak, really.
Well, it's good that you keep plugging away. I think that's nice.
Yeah.
And do you find, are you now at the stage where you just find it amusing? And
I am very bemused, I would say. In fact, when I posted my forlorn message, if anything, I was bemused, but then quite distressed later when many, many people were sending me messages of support saying, "Keep going, keep going. Because next time, what I do the next time, maybe two or three people will come then. I could just build on that platform."
Yeah. Was that almost even more upsetting, the fact that people were kind of reaching out
perhaps,
to you in a slightly pitying way?
I wonder. Well, because, I mean, obviously having nobody is something of an event, whereas if it had been, let's say, four or five, that would have been just run-of-the-mill, bog-standard, tedious and banal.
Yeah. And then some patronising podcast came and said, "Hey, David, come on. Come on, you can come and read a poem on our show."
Right.
Yeah, that's nice.
Am I self-trolling now then? the moment.
I don't know. It's completely circularly meta now. I've no idea who's genuine and who's right. not. Yeah, so, no, it's impossible.
I'm calculating what degree of contempt. In fact, you're radiating in my direction now.
It's always difficult to
fellow feeling derision.
It just appealed to us purely for obviously we are called the Failing Writers Podcast, and we like to celebrate success and failure in equal measure.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think it is important to jump straight to the meta level and to displace it onto a different alternative level of comedy and deeper insight into the human condition.
That is the way that we like to deal with failure, definitely.
Yeah.
So you have a poem to share with us.
Well, why not? Yeah, I just used the much-used Scots word dreek there.
Yeah.
And the poem I've selected is called A Diurnal Upon St. Lucy's Day. So a reference there to John Donne and his thoughts on St. Lucy's Day, which is the shortest day of the year,
right.
unlike the looming longest day of the year. But, the sun doesn't get very high over the horizon in these parts anyway, so it's always dark. So why not? It's a one-page poem.
Lovely.
And I won't detain you too long, in other words. And here we go. It just uses one Scots word, the word bield, which means sustenance or comfort. This handful of earth we have selected. Enter its landscape. You are expected. And while you drift to sleep, my son, and dream of the circuit drive you're on, we leave the village by the bridge where the Afford Railway meets the hitch of track and bridge both running out. And weeping her small circling note, a curlew flies from flooded field to field in search of reeds and bield. Oh, Benahi, Pit Fitian, Cairn William, three wise tors that stand above the snaking river Don, and whose stone circles kiss the sun on solstice mornings when worlds touch and snowdrifts dazzle patch on patch, hem us in against the cold, poor sheep foregathered in the fold, who stare like them and see our gaze return to us from their blank eyes. A quarry guards its sunken wound beyond the pinewood clearance meant for houses, but left raked and bare. Grant us, O Lord, our freehold here and our small hypocrite descent, when later waves presume to plant their tarmac lawns of spacious drives, tailgaters come to live our lives and multiply the daily round from village lanes to far-flung town. Turning for home, we hug the wall of Cluny Castle's darkling pile and hear the congregated geese, their heckles pecking at the breeze. We come, we go, a migrant tide, our lights are islanded in shade, the paths we took pure instinct now, as the gritters and the snows allow. This permanence we grow into, this passing accident we pass through. There you go.
It's very nice. Brilliant. Very nice.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Tell us a bit about that poem and where it came from.
Just from looking at the mountains on the horizon that ring this little region where I live in north central Aberdeenshire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's it.
That's more or less it. Well, I have two young children, so I get a lot. Most, in fact, my inspiration comes from just either looking out the window or a car window if necessary, or village hall is visible in the distance and people are gathering there for cultural events.
Or not.
Yeah.
It sounds like you are you driving your kids around to get them to sleep or something? Was it? It was something.
I think I was, probably returning from Tesco or someplace. So, rendezvous and the child was asleep. So I prolonged that by just driving along and looking at a map.
Just keep going. Keep going. We've all been there.
David, thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Okay. Well, good luck with the Victorian limericks anyway.
Yeah,
some of which were quite smutty.
Oh, yeah. We got plenty of that.
Yeah.
And thanks for
having
me on.
Thank you,
Cheers,
buddy.
Take care. Well, that was a fun-packed, fun-filled episode, John. I think you'll agree. I think everyone would agree. It's not even in question, actually. I don't need anyone else's agreement. It absolutely was.
Yeah, there was too much there, frankly, Tom.
Too much.
Way too much.
If you've listened to all that in one go, well done. Please exit through the gift shop and collect your I listened to the whole episode.
That was at least two dog walks, wasn't it, worth, I reckon.
Yeah, possibly, depending on the size of the dog. But next week, do join us. So we will be back next week, even though we're only meant to be doing every other week. But we are doing
I wondered when we'd break. Limericks. You know what I mean? When would we snap?
We're doing a limerick special.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely doing just every 2 weeks so we've got time to write. Apart from, I think we've only done that once so far this season. But yeah, next week, limerick special. A little bit of a hopefully interesting look at the history of the limerick. And then me, John, and hopefully Dave will be presenting some limericks that we've written, and hopefully some of yours as well, so get writing.
Don't forget to write some limericks, get them in before Thursday, and we'll feature them on the episode.
Brilliant.
So there we go. Right. I think that's it, isn't it? I think we've finally run out of words, and that's the end of this podcast. This here is going to be my last word of the podcast coming up in a minute. Can you guess what it's going to be, Tom?
I was going to say goodbye. I'm going to go for ta-ra.
Horseradish.
Well, that's not even a... That's not a... That's random.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?
Don't know how to leave. I don't know how to leave. I'm trying to leave. I can't leave. I'm stuck. I'm stuck here forever. Let's do another one. Hang on. The only way I can leave is by switching the machine off. I'm going to switch the machine off. Right, see you all again.